All right, should be live. Hey everybody, Rob Mauer here. Today we are joined by Dave Lee from his YouTube channel, Dave Lee on Investing. Dave and I were chatting. We had a conversation on Dave's channel a couple weeks back, and we didn't quite have as much time to get to all the topics that we wanted to cover, so we figured let's continue the conversation. So we thought we'd kind of do something where we kind of flip the mic around a little bit, and Dave's going to ask me a lot of questions, and then, you know, next week or 2 weeks from now, we're going to kind of reverse it, and I'm going to go on his channel and ask him some questions. So we just thought today we could talk, you know, a lot about Tesla, what we're doing and our investment strategies, and then hopefully get into a lot of the Tesla stuff, as well as towards the end, just our general investing strategies and things like that. So I hope you guys enjoy it, and we'll get started. Dave, you got any questions for me?
Yeah, so thanks, Rob. I've actually got a ton of questions here. I wanted to ask you, like, how often you check Tesla stock price on a daily basis. I wanted to ask you also if there's any price that Tesla can go to this, like, in the next few months that would tempt you to sell a decent portion of your Tesla shares. And I wanted to ask you about your Model 3, you know, purchase, why you got that over the Model Y. So there's a bunch of these personal questions, but
yeah.
I wanted to start
well, should we start? Should we start with the stock price? That's a great place
actually,
to start.
I wanted to start out with more Tesla stuff first, and then kind of dive into more personal things. I kind of wanted to actually ask you about your investing strategies as well, kind of how you view diversification risk, how you view options versus stock. I'd love to just dive into this stuff. But first,
for sure.
I wanted to ask your thoughts on Tesla right now and going forward. We know that Tesla has had, like, you know, an amazing past, you know, decade. And as we look out, let's say next year, what's kind of the most exciting thing that you see for Tesla? Like, I mean, there's a bunch of stuff like full self-driving, battery factory, Cybertruck, profits, but what's kind of the thing that kind of, you know, tantalizes your focus? Like, you're thinking, this is the biggest thing that I think personally.
Yeah, for sure. And there's a couple things there. So a lot of questions there. Let's start off with just the stock price. I mean, I check it a lot. I think it's not necessary for people to check the stock price, you know, every single day or every single hour or whatever. It really depends on your investment strategy, which is some of the stuff we're going to get into. For me, I'm really mixed in terms of my style. I do most of my position is long-term investment that I really built from like 2013 to 2015, 2016. And those shares I'm pretty much just going to hold. But I do also have sort of in my tax protected accounts, more short-term stuff that I don't have to worry about, you know, the tax impact of short-term trades. So I do a lot of options trading specifically on Tesla in those accounts too. So for those reasons, I am, you know, checking it. And then also just because I do Tesla daily, like I have to, part of that is being informed on what's happening with the stock and if there are any big movements, you know, during the day or anything like that, I kind of have to be following those. So that's kind of the thoughts on the stock price. But I'd say in general, investors do check stock prices too frequently. You know, I think there's some research out there that maybe it was like Fidelity or E-Trade or something. They looked at like the accounts that performed best across their entire brokerage. And it was actually investors that unfortunately had passed away and were no longer managing their accounts because the inaction, you know, led to them not making bad decisions, where they just let their account go and, you know, over time it builds up. So, you know, I think a lot of investors think, you know, I always have to be making trades or I always have to be taking some sort of action. But, you know, every single second, every single minute, every single hour, every single day that you're not doing something, like, you're holding, and that is a decision in and of itself. So
I'm curious, have you noticed, like, when you are in certain option trades, especially say for Tesla, that your stress level kind of goes up, your, like, attention to the stock price kind of heightens? Like how do you deal with that?
I would say a little bit. I feel like I manage my stress well, but I don't know. Now that I'm thinking about it, I don't know that that is fully true because I'm very, you know, deadline oriented and stuff like that. So it must impact me in some way. Sorry, there's some sirens going, but yeah, I think it definitely, you know, changes your mentality a little bit. But the important part for me, at least, is to be aware of that and, you know, to understand how that affects sort of your decision making or your psychological approach to investing, because it definitely does. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're just holding a stock and you made the decision, okay, I'm just going to hold this for 10 years, you know, you don't have to really worry too much about what's going on day to day. But if you're in those trades, yeah, you're way more focused on that. It can be stressful at times, but I think paying attention to your level of stress and making sure you're not getting into trades that are too stressful is extremely important. Like, unfortunately, I do have listeners that'll, you know, if the stock is down 6% or 8% or something like that, you know, they're asking like, why is this? Like, this is so frustrating. If you're feeling those feelings, you know, on a day that the stock is down really any percent, then you're probably either over leveraged or over invested. You know, you need to analyze like why you're feeling that certain way. And I think maybe adjust your strategy so that at least you're not feeling that way or you're not making decisions, you know, based on those feelings. So.
I'm curious, you come across as very, thoughtful and collected and calm, and I would imagine like common stock would fit your personality in some ways, like maybe more adaptively. But it seems like options, like what is the appeal for options, And I'm curious also, like what are your favorite strategies? Are you doing more like less risk averse stuff, like spreads or selling, covered calls or stuff like that, or are you actually, doing like, calls out of the money or in the money? Like, kind of, what's
Sure.
your kind of risk
Sure.
tolerance there?
Well, okay, so I think we're getting into the investment stuff early. Let's shift back to the Tesla stuff. So you did ask like, you know, what
Sure.
am I looking forward to for next year? And we will come back to that question for sure, because that's a great question.
Sure.
But, you know, in terms of like what Tesla is doing right now and what I'm looking forward to next year, I think there are two big things that come to mind immediately for me. I'll start with the first one, which I think is slightly less important. And that is just the leverage that Tesla is generating with the growth of their business right now from an operations perspective, from a profitability perspective. I continue to feel like this is being underappreciated by pretty much everybody, like even on the bullish side. You know, I think some people do understand it, but over the last 12 months, you know, 18 months, we've seen that shift where Tesla was negative before in terms of profitability, and now they're suddenly all of a sudden profitable and have been consistently so. Because they've reached the scale now with, you know, the Model 3 pretty much fully ramped up, at least from Fremont. That's really, you know, changed the game for Tesla. And I think we're just in the early stages of that. So, you know, last quarter Tesla delivered what, I think like 137,000 vehicles. This quarter, you know, they're trying to hit about 180,000 to get to 500,000 for the year. I actually think they can do. You know, I ran through my forecast maybe a month ago. I actually think they can get to about a couple hundred thousand produced this quarter. And depending on how the delivery versus production number shake out and how much inventory either builds or declines, you know, I do think they have a shot at 200,000 deliveries in Q4. So in the span of, you know, 6 months, they went from delivering 80, 90,000 vehicles to 180, 200,000 vehicles. And that's, you don't see that in businesses that are the scale of Tesla very often. So people don't realize how big of an impact that's going to have fundamentally on the numbers that Tesla is posting. And then we're also simultaneous to that, we're seeing the earnings numbers currently being a little bit suppressed because of Elon Musk's compensation package. So stock-based compensation right now is pretty high as Tesla hits a lot of those tranches from Elon's compensation package. So that I think is, you know, maybe lulling people into this false sense of security about where Tesla's profitability levels are. And I think they're just about to kind of explode here. You know, we haven't really seen price drops from Tesla this quarter. They did it on the Model S, but that was about it. Maybe they've done it in some international markets as well. We saw the introduction of the new Standard Range Plus lithium iron phosphate Model 3 from Shanghai. But largely, it seems like prices have held, and they've actually increased the price of the full self-driving option. So that's a big one. And then, as we've talked about a lot, a lot of that revenue is deferred, so a lot of that profit's not actually hitting the bottom line now from full self-driving. So you have sort of these significant leverages being generated from Tesla's core business, and then on top of that, you're piling on more recognition for a higher priced full self-driving option, and all of a sudden it's like, oh my gosh, like profitability just tripled, even though revenue was only up 100% or something like that. So long-winded answer, but that's just Q4. And then if we extend that to next year, where Tesla's, you know, growing 50 to 100% again in terms of deliveries, And then 2022, when they do the same thing again, that's, I think, really going to catch people off guard. A lot of people ask, oh, Tesla's price to earnings is like 1200 right now. Like, why? How is that not overvalued? But if you start to walk through the math, you can easily pretty much get to a situation where Tesla is, 4Xing their earnings or 6Xing their earnings with only growing revenue maybe 100, 200%. So yeah, I'll end it there. And then I guess the second one I would say is just full self-driving. We're seeing the feature complete rollout now. I think it's going to be quite a while until, things are actually like an autonomous robotaxi situation. But I think all of us have to be pretty pleased that there's tangible progress being made here, in a very exciting way. So I'm really, really excited to see how that plays out, over the next year.
Yeah, I'm actually fascinated by this your answers, because I actually resonate very deeply with both of these things, and I think like both of them in some ways aren't fully appreciated. Regarding operating leverage, can you help people who are watching kind of understand kind of what that is and why people might not completely get it initially? Like, what's
Yeah,
behind the scenes of that?
absolutely. And this is something that goes back pretty much, for Tesla's entire history. So if you think about a business, especially a business that's growing rapidly like Tesla's has been, you have a situation where you're having to pay for things and scale things that are not going to generate revenue for you ahead of time. And the simplest example of that is, building a factory. So Tesla's building factories in, they're expanding in Shanghai, they're building new factories in Berlin, Texas. Those things are adding cost, and that may not necessarily hit profitability right away because, it's a capital expenditure, so that's on the cash side. But it does come back through depreciation and amortization. A lot of that is time-based stuff, not necessarily unit-based. It's mixed for Tesla, but even if something is, it's a capital expenditure, there are still expenses that they have to pay for those, before they're generating revenue. And then if you think about their operations, they need to have superchargers, covering basically the entire United States, the entirety of Europe, the entirety of China, that, maybe the utilization is high in some areas, but if we think across the entire country or countries, a lot of those superchargers aren't necessarily being used, but Tesla needs to have them there. They need to pay for those superchargers upfront just so people can have the option of using them. But that's a perfect example of operating leverage because they've got to put one supercharger there for the first customer to be able to use it. But then as, their neighbor and their neighbor's neighbor and all these other people buy Teslas, they can still go and use that same supercharger. So you can see like, okay, in 2014, there was one Tesla using the supercharger, but in 2021, maybe there's eight that are using them frequently, and you're generating eight times the amount of, utility from this that you were back in 2014. So if you apply that across Tesla's, entire business, their service centers, their stores, their supercharger network, even just production, as they get more production out of their factories, the depreciation per unit comes down. So it's just all these things as revenue grows, the costs per unit come down significantly, and that's why you see this flip from not being profitable, where you had all these shorts being like, "Oh, Tesla's fundamentally unprofitable. Like they lose money on every car they sell." That was never true at all. Tesla's always made money on the cars they've sold. It just hasn't been enough to cover those other costs of the business. But now over the last 12 months, we've seen that flip to where now it's covering the cost of the business, and that's not going to change. It's only going to get better and better from here. So that's kind of the operating leverage that we're talking about.
Sure. Like one of the interesting things about Tesla the past several years is we haven't seen their operating expenses, like namely like their research and development, the general SG&A line.
SG&A,
We
yep.
haven't seen it really go up that much. Like it's been very constant, whereas their production and revenue has just skyrocketed in the same time. Like, have you noticed that? And kind of what are your kind of thoughts regarding that?
Yeah, I have. And I was actually, that was one of my core, I don't know, core things I was trying to get out there back in like 2017, 2018. I went on this podcast called Adventures in Finance, which I later realized was pretty much run by a full on like Tesla Q person. but I was explaining that concept of like, if you look back the trailing kind of 3 years back in 2017, you were starting to see the signs of that where SG&A as a percent of sales was dropping from, maybe like 22% to 20% to 18%. And you could actually look at how SG&A compared to forward revenue, because you have to understand that some of those SG&A costs, those are, ahead of revenue, because Tesla has to hire people to work their stores before they can sell a car, for example. So you could start to see that leverage being generated. I am pretty surprised with how strong they've been, or how strongly they've been able to leverage that. Like, I would have expected by now we would have seen those costs start to increase. But if you look at just the straight costs, not even the percentages, like you said, R&D and SG&A, they've pretty much held steady for the last, 8 to 10 quarters, even though revenue is probably 3x in that period of time. So it's pretty impressive. And Tesla talks about it pretty much on every single earnings call, but I think a lot of people just kind of sit there and like, oh yeah, like I'm generating operating leverage, like cool. But they're doing, pretty remarkable work in that regards. And tons of credit to Tesla and to Elon and to Zach for being able to pull that off.
Yeah, I definitely like see that. Like sometimes I call Tesla like a lean machine, because like they've almost like done the impossible in a sense. Like they've scaled right an entire Model 3 program, factories, Model Y, yet their operating expenses are like fairly flat. And I'm like, wow, there must have been a lot of focus and discipline. Like in your opinion, how much, let's say for example, did Zach Kirkhorn, their CFO, like what was his role, you think, in this whole thing?
Yeah, it's tough to say. I mean, the Tesla's a lot of it's a massive company. They have a lot of people making decisions. It's never the result of one person. But I would say since Zach has come in, it definitely seems like there's been, more focus on generating that operating leverage and, keeping costs down, keeping costs in control. And you can go back to, and around that period of time, they were talking a lot about that on those, 2018 time period earnings calls, really as Model 3 was starting to ramp up. And I think Tesla was really taking a hard look at their business structure around that point in time. If we fast forward a couple months from that, we saw them go through that period of time of like, okay, we're closing, most of our stores. And then a couple weeks later, it was like, okay, just kidding, we're not closing most of our stores. We're actually going to build more stores. So you could tell, unfortunately, the timing around that was pretty bad because the stock was kind of tanking, so it didn't look the best from a sentiment perspective. But you could kind of tell that they're in that reevaluation period. And I think a lot of what happened with the Model 3 ramp up did surprise them. Like, it obviously didn't go as smoothly as they expected. And I think that caused them to take a really close look of like, okay, we're kind of struggling here. How can we get through this period of time? Well, we can bring our costs down, and that's going to give us more runway as low as we can keep those costs. So in hindsight, that might have actually been a good thing that Tesla did have those struggles at that period of time, because, sort of out of those struggles, there are things that are found that are going to benefit Tesla now from, the next 2 decades. So how much of that is Zach? How much of that is situational? Who knows?
Sure.
But just in general, I've been very happy with the work that that Zach has done.
Yeah, I think also with operating leverage, it's often underappreciated. Like what you referred to before with depreciation amortization, it's like in the early days of Tesla, they're building these factories, but they're really inefficient. Like they're
Right.
spending billions and billions in the Gigafactory, et cetera. And they have to depreciate, and amortize all those expenses into their current cars over time. And so that's a high expense, and it's something that weighs down the margins until you have like those expenses get depreciated, and then you have new factories which are much more
Even
efficient,
bigger. Yeah.
yeah, bigger, and they're spread out over more cars, and so
And they're
the
not necessarily in
impact.
California.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, can you explain kind of what the impact, like how does that affect profitability, and like how much do you think that might affect gross margin, let's say?
Yeah, I wish I had the numbers in front of me. I don't have them right now for, what percent of the costs are depreciation and amortization, but the concept itself is pretty simple. Let's say you're expensing $100 million per year. Let's say your factory costs $500 million and you're amortizing that over 5 years, so you're expensing $100 million per year. If you're only in your first year managed to get like one vehicle produced, then the entirety of that cost is going to be applied to that one vehicle. It's going to cost $100 million. This is simplifying things because it's part of its time-based, part of its unit-based. So this is a simplified concept, but the gist of it is that all of that expense is going to be applied to whatever you produce. So as you grow your production, you're increasing the denominator, I think. And that's going to lower just the per unit price. So instead of $100 million on one unit, if you're producing 1 million units, well, instead of $100 million, it's just $100 per car. So as production doubles or triples or quadruples, your costs there come down significantly. And I wish I had, what percent of the cost of goods sold or depreciation and amortization for Tesla, but it's definitely been a major factor in terms of how Tesla's able to grow their gross margin, which then, compounds on down through the line, through operational and then final net income. So yeah, it's been a huge factor.
Yeah, I'm very excited about operating leverage and profits, especially since 2018 or so. I was like making that the main kind of exciting kind of thesis for Tesla in the next few years, because partly it's like I don't think a lot of people were understanding like the business model or just the how Tesla will generate profits at a certain point, because their operations are so lean. As they grow revenue, their profits just increase, radically. Why, in your opinion, do you think, I wouldn't say like everyone didn't get it, but there were a lot of analysts out there who maybe just didn't get it, or just maybe, I don't know if they didn't get it, or if they were just emphasizing the risks, the current like risks, let's say in 2018 or 2019, that they just didn't like really factor in, what's going to happen this year, next year, and the following years? Or was it something else? I mean, what's your kind of take on like how this, story is misunderstood?
Well, I think it's a combination of a lot of different factors. Like you have analysts that are, forecasting Tesla to not be able to ever produce or sell anything close to, multiple 100,000 Model 3s per year. Which at the time, if you don't know a ton about Tesla, it kind of makes sense. It's like, okay, this electric vehicle and the market's just, less than 1%. Like this is not going to be the top selling car in its segment. That's a pretty easy statement to make, but if you follow Tesla more closely and you've talked to people that have driven Teslas or you've driven a Tesla yourself, you kind of understand like, oh, this is a game changer. And like obviously this is going to be the best selling car because it's, at $40,000, $50,000, it's way better than anything else that you're going to get out there in terms of the value proposition. So you kind of have those competing schools of thought of why would this car ever sell this well versus like, oh, clearly it's going to sell better than its competition. So on the analyst side, I think you have, they fall more in that first category of saying like trying to use benchmarks and using this top-down analysis of like, okay, maybe Tesla takes their share from, 1% up to 2% or something like that, and they sell 50,000 to 100,000 of these Model 3s, and they put that in their model. Well, you're never going to get to profitability with those sort of numbers. So that's a part of it. And then you have them looking at, okay, the margins on the Model S right now are, 20 to 25% in general at that period of time. And that's a $90,000 car. Like, okay, how is Tesla going to take that and go to this, slightly smaller car and all of a sudden sell it for $35,000 and then make margin on that? So you have them putting in super low margins, maybe 5%, 10% gross margin, which isn't going to be enough to cover your operating costs. So then you never have them flipping over, you have low scale, you have low margins, and that's never going to flip over into profitability. And to their credit, like it's fair to be skeptical of those things. It was kind of that's a difficult thing that Tesla has done, Tesla fans kind of get it and it was sort of expected, but it's really unprecedented and this is like insane what Tesla has accomplished. So I can't fault anyone for not necessarily predicting that, especially with analysts that have to have something that is defensible in their argument from like or in their analysis from a numbers perspective. And a lot of that stuff at that time just wasn't. So if you don't have that scale, if you don't have those margins, it's never going to flip to profitable. And then you have like, okay, why does Tesla have this multi tens of billions of dollars in valuation if they're never going to be profitable fundamentally because they can't get to that scale. And then you sort of lose interest on what's going to happen in 2030 if you don't even see them succeeding, in 2023. So I think it's kind of a combination of all those little things that Tesla just, consistently has overachieved on those expectations. And now we're at the point where people are like, oh my gosh, like look at what they just did with the Model 3. Like it's the leading car. Like Model Y probably going to do the same. Oh, look at what they did in Shanghai. They ramped up to 200,000 vehicle per year production rate in 12 months. Like, okay, well, that's a precedent that we can use, and we can apply that to Giga Berlin, Giga Texas, and then all of a sudden, the path to Tesla being this multi-million cars per year type of company is like super clear. And then you have this competition that's coming out and not competitive. So they've given their best effort. Well, it's an even clearer path for Tesla. So that's why we've seen this shift in valuation so dramatically over the last 12 months, is because like all that stuff has, become clear now.
Yeah, it seems like part of the world, at least the investment world, that's been sleeping kind of on Tesla or just kind of ignoring it, now he's like woke up, right? And you have this
All of a
massive
sudden.
realization, yeah, all of a sudden, and the stock price reflects that. I mean, if I was to be talking with you last year, let's say Tesla's at 300 at some point in
I
2000,
wish,
yeah, or yeah, this pre-stock split price, let's say 300. And I say, hey, Rob, Tesla's gonna go to 3,000, in 2020. Like, what would be your reaction? Would you think I'm crazy, or would you be
Oh
like,
man. It's so tough because like I haven't sold any shares on this like way up, so you're kind of reevaluating things every single day. But if you had told me that at that point in time, I would have been like, no chance. Like the market's not going to realize it, and that's been the biggest surprise for me, is like how suddenly the realization has happened in the market for Tesla to go from at their low last year, last June, they were like $176 per share, which would be what, $35 right now. Post split. Like that's insane. 18 months ago, $35. Now we're at 600, like almost a 20x in the course of 18 months. Like that is insane. And I never would have expected that to happen, because I wouldn't expect the market to figure this out so quickly. Like I still think the company, I think the valuation is fair and will continue to grow. So the valuation itself is, I'm fine with it. It's just, I would not have expected the market to apply that valuation. But we have seen, a lot of things come together. There's a lot of this hype now in the EV space. Like, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about like QuantumScape and what's been going on with all these SPACs and all these other electric vehicle makers that now have $20 to $80 billion valuations. It's just been, it's been kind of a crazy year. So long-winded answer, but I definitely would have been surprised, and unfortunately so, because there are people on the Tesla Motors Club's forums that are like, oh, I bought these like $1, $700 strike calls on Tesla back in around that time period of time for like January of 2021, and now those are up like 500x. Just like, shoot, like why didn't I buy those? So I can't say I expected this, because I didn't position myself like that. I was coming off a margin call, so I was being conservative,
Actually,
unfortunately,
like,
but.
yeah, I kind of actually, man, I feel like in some ways, like, talking with like you and others who have gone through the ups and downs, I feel like a camaraderie of depthness, like a brotherhood, a brethren, right?
Been through the ringer.
But yeah, it's like it's interesting because, going through the shadow of the valley of death in 2018, early 2019, and just holding the shares, and it took a lot of mental fortitude in a sense to just, hold through that time and really believe in the future. And like going into 2020, I was like, man, 2020 is going to be a great year for Tesla with profitability, S&P 500, and all this stuff. And I'm like, I could see the stock doubling, maybe tripling. And I'm like, maybe I should go bigger in some option calls. But then on the flip side, it's like a person who's had a traumatic experience, before that, years before that, where you're just like, oh, I think I'm just happy with common shares, it's like just to be part of it. So it seems like if you hadn't had gone through as traumatic of an experience before, maybe you could have took a bit more risk, at least
Yeah,
in my perspective,
for sure.
going into 2020. But yeah, I
Yeah.
mean, 500x on option call, jeez.
Right, which that's a rare circumstance. Like that, a lot needs to happen for that to happen. And part of that reason, I think it's like a lot of us have been a little bit snake bitten by options in the past because, like, you see this thing that's playing out, and it's super clear of like what's going to happen, but you also have to bet on the market understanding that by a certain period of time, which that's like the most difficult part. And people will oftentimes play options around like earnings or something, and it's like, okay, we're expecting an earnings beat. And you can be totally right on that, and then the stock can go down, and it's just like, well, what the heck? My analysis was right. But it doesn't matter. All that matters is the reaction in the stock, obviously. So having been through that one too many periods of time over, the period from 2013 to 2019, where it's like, why is the valuation still the same? This is insane. Look at the Model 3, it's like the best-selling car. Like, nothing like this has ever happened before. It's obviously like an iPhone moment of vehicles, and there's just no recognition. So it's like, okay, well, when is that going to happen? And you just don't know. Like, it should have happened earlier. I think we can pretty clearly say that at this point in time, but it just didn't. And then all of a sudden, like that, it just happened. So
Yeah, no, I
yeah,
completely,
that's
yeah,
what's hard
completely,
about
totally.
options. You have to get the timing,
Yeah.
and there's deadlines. You have your time decay. It's a tricky game.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, betting on timing adds so much complexity because there's so many things out of your control. It's just a completely, different ball game. I'm curious, like, have you been tempted at all? Like, I mean, this is like, the pre-split price, the stock is 176 year and a half ago. Now it's jumped to 3,000, let's say pre-split price. Like, are you tempted to take even just a bit off the table, like, just to diversify a bit or to buy buy something like a house or something?
Model 3. Well, I'm
Model
financing my
3.
Model 3, so I guess the answer is no. So as I said at the beginning, most of my core shares are in my taxed account. So I think, part of that kind of locks me in of like, okay, I don't want to pay my taxes. I don't want to have to sell here and then bet on it going back, to going down 30% to have to, cover whatever the difference in the tag, 20% or whatever. So that kind of keeps me locked in on those core shares. And then the rest of it is options. And invariably, when I buy options, you're supposed to hold them like 50% of the way, because that's like optimal for time decay versus, the implied volatility, et cetera. And I always am just too bullish where I just like never sell them, because I'm just like, okay, well, I still feel good about them surpassing this, my strike price plus what the premium is right now by the end of the contract. So I usually end up holding them. And then, even through this run up, that's pretty much been the case for me. So I kind of sell when I have to based on the expiration of those options. But other than that, I haven't really been super tempted. Probably the most tempting thing would be this S&P inclusion, because it's sort of a weird event, that's not really based on Tesla's fundamentals, and I don't think any of us really know what's going to happen. So that presents like an opportunity. If Tesla doubles, I would have to think pretty hard about selling some, because I don't think a business that's selling, $30 billion a year in revenue at, a relatively low margin at this point in time is probably not worth $1 trillion yet. So, and I don't think it'd be able to quite sustain that, even though I do think if we fast forward 10 years, $1 trillion valuation today, you're still going to probably get a good return on that. But again, it's about like the market perception, and I don't think the market's going to give that much credit to Tesla this early. But the risk for that is, okay, what if they do? And what if that does continue? Like, the market can surprise you, and it can be, I can't remember that phrase, but like something about it, it's something about longer than you can stay solvent. The market can be irrational longer than you can stay
Sure.
solvent. So, and that applies to if you're trying to rebuy it too. Like, the market can be irrational to the high end too, longer than you can sit around and wait to buy. So it's tough. If it doubled, maybe I would consider taking some of those core shares off. The options, yeah, I'll just have to decide. Like, that's sort of a day by day decision. I have some expiring today. I have some expiring, in like next June. So it's just kind of a mix.
Are you doing like mostly like longer dated stuff, like 6 to 12 months or longer? Are you doing like short term, or is it just a complete mix of everything?
It's a mix. It just kind of depends. Like if there's a certain event that I'm feeling particularly bullish on, like the S&P inclusion, that's why I have a little bit more of like December stuff. Or if, and it really depends on like what the implied volatility is too, and what the premiums are. So, and that changes pretty significantly for Tesla. I think it was just around like 50. Now it's at like 110 or something over the, that changed in like 2 weeks. So that's going to influence like what strikes you're taking. And, I'm sure you talked about a lot of this with Emmett Peppers and stuff, but, yeah, it just, for me, it's kind of a daily decision based on how much capital I have available to me based on what my positions are at that point in time and just what the events are that are occurring. But in general, like the options for me are, it's a small part of my portfolio. Like I am
Yeah,
mostly just in the core stock.
in the course too. So I see, got it. So I mean, I guess your IRA or your taxed advantaged account. I mean, it must have done pretty well this year,
It's done well, yeah. So I mean, not surprising to anyone, Tesla is overweight in my portfolio. It's yeah, I'm definitely like I'm not into diversification, and I think every investor should have their own strategy, and it's going to vary by individual. So for me, I still have a relatively long time horizon for my investing, and I think it's always a balance between like what your income is and what your level of capital is. And I think the more that skews towards income and the longer the time horizon you have, the riskier in general you should be with your capital, because if you're not taking excess risk, in general, you're not gonna outperform. So you have to balance that and find the areas of opportunity where there's the imbalance there. But in general, I would say, younger people that have a longer time horizon, that have more of their net worth or more of their, whatever, their assets coming in from income versus sort of their nest egg, be more aggressive at that point in time. But like once you're, a little bit further along in your investing journey and you've got, those gains and you have that capital, then at that point you have to decide of, okay, maybe 4% of your a 4% withdrawal rate on your capital is going to earn you more than working your job would. And at that point, like, why are you going to risk everything in like a super high risk investment, like Tesla $700 calls or something like that? So you just kind of have to decide based on your risk tolerance and your time horizon and everything like that. But for me, I don't like diversification for myself personally, because I want to generate those excess returns, and I believe that I can based on my analysis and track record. So for me, I'm kind of like, I'm gonna find this one investment, I'm gonna pretty much go all in on it, and that's what I've done in Tesla, pretty much for the last decade or so. Like I do have other investments, but Tesla now going up 15x from probably my cost basis. I don't know if that's accurate, but it's obviously a the vast majority of my portfolio, probably 90, 95 to 100% now at this point. So
It's interesting. You bring up actually some really important concepts here. One is kind of like the impact of loss. For example, if you lose a lot of your investments, it means different. It has a different meaning if you're closer, let's say, to retirement, or you can't make up that loss,
right.
or if you're depending on that loss, right? Or depending on that money for security, right, in the future. Versus if you're earlier in life where, let's say, that amount is not, you're not so dependent because you have so much time, to work and income and to save, et cetera. So it seems like those profiles are very different, with investing. And it seems
Exactly.
like if you're young, especially if you have high income and you're young, and you're so risk averse where you don't want to touch anything, and you believe that, complete diversification is the way, it seems like there would be some missed opportunity there. Because if you could combine the belief that there are these great opportunities that you could find with maybe rigorous due diligence and research that could help reduce some of that risk, it seems like there's huge opportunities, especially in an age of technology disruption, innovation. If you can catch some of those, a big winner like a Tesla or something. it seems like the reward is just mind-boggling, of what you can achieve compared to if it's just stuck in like a 3 or 4%, return, safer investment.
Exactly. And the way that I kind of think about it, like, let's imagine like a, 23, 24-year-old, and they've saved up, $5,000 or $10,000, let's say 10,000 just for simple math. If they invest that just in, an index fund, they're going to get maybe 7% returns. Maybe that doubles in 10 years. Lately the market's been doing better, so let's say that doubles in 7 years or something like that. So you've taken that 10,000, 7 years later, you got $20,000. Well, for a 30-year-old, $20,000 that's, been working in their career for 8 years now. Let's say they're in a good financial position coming out of college. They worked through it, or their parents paid for it, whatever the case may be, or they've just been diligently paying down their debt. $20,000 for them at that point in their career, if, this is a high income earner, is not going to be really significant for them. So it's like, okay, well, why not take that $10,000 and try to get maybe a little bit better return by being in something that's a little bit more concentrated that you've done the analysis on and that you believe in? Because if you lose that $10,000, well, your income, you're going to make up for that in, whatever period of time, less than a year. Versus if you take that $10,000 and you invest it and you can find a company that 5x's or 10x's, well, then you're at, when you're 30, you have $50,000 or $100,000, and that's going to get you, great down payment on a house, a vehicle. Like, that's going to actually provide some value into your life. And not to say that $20,000 is nothing. This is just sort of an example for this one hypothetical person. That's still a lot of money, but you can get to a more game-changing amount of money from being more concentrated. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people don't really, think about that way. They only just think about, like, oh my gosh, like, this $10,000 was so hard for me to earn, and I don't want to lose it. But if you
Yeah,
fast forward like
definitely.
15, 20 years, like, that's not going to be that important to you. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. I think yeah, I mean, it also helps like if you do have higher income and higher savings rates, like where you can make that up quicker. If it takes you like 5 or 10 years to save up $10,000 or $15,000, then it's maybe it feels like it is a much bigger amount. I mean, your
Exactly.
case, coming from the job and industry that you were part of before going full time, and having that higher income, did that help you think to kind of save more and to be more, a little bit more risk taking in your investments?
Yeah, absolutely. And it, like, I didn't have that high of income, but I saved like super, super aggressively. Like, I paid my first like 6 years out of college, I want to say. I literally lived in a basement. There was a window, but I lived in a basement. I had two other roommates. I was paying like $600 a rent here in Milwaukee. So that gave me, and I didn't have a car payment. My car was paid off, and that gave me a lot of opportunity to, put a lot into investing versus someone that's maybe paying, $1,200 in rent. They have like a $300 car payment where, I'm saving $1,000 more per month than they are. And that's, $12,000 every year that you can then invest in stocks. So it, those little differences, can add up, and you don't necessarily need to be a high income earner. It really is about like your savings rate, as you talked about. But sort of on that line of thought, like, for me, that's one of the reasons that I didn't do any like postgraduate schooling, is because, I understand this time value of money and the opportunity that there is in investing. So, like, for me, it was like, okay, I don't want to pay an additional $50,000, $100,000 to get like my MBA or to pursue something in, like the medical field or anything like that, where I'm going to be in school till I'm, 28 or 30 years old, and then have a lot of debt on top of that, where, maybe in 5 years from then, or 3 to 5 years from then, I'm finally able to start investing. Well, I'd rather start investing at 22 than at 35, even if that gives me sort of a better, income when I'm 35. I just didn't see the value for that when you've got that, that route for investing. So, yeah, I mean, the summary is like, save your money, invest, as much as you can, as early as you can. And I think when you're in that situation, that opens you up to be able to take those risks and to be able to get that outsized reward. And that, that's the type of stuff that can, be pretty life-changing for some people.
Yeah, interesting. What is your kind of motivation for investing? Like, at a certain point, it might be like, there might be some, freedom, it allows for freedom or allows for retirement, et cetera. But I mean, past a certain point, like, I mean, is there something more to investing? Is there something that attracts you to it that you see that, I don't know, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think it's two parts. So definitely like me having the knowledge of investing and having, at least a little bit of a nest egg, like by the time that I was, getting ready to like consider taking this podcast full time, that definitely gave me the confidence that like, okay, if something bad happens, at least I can like survive for a little bit with the money that I've saved. So it opens up new opportunities. And, because I had that, I've now made this decision, which, to this point has been a very good decision. I'm very happy with that choice. I feel like I'm just providing a lot more value to the world now than I was, working at that corporate retail job. So for me, even just having that, even if I'm not actually using that money or spending it on anything, it gives you those options and it gives you sort of that confidence and that flexibility to maybe take some time off or pursue this side hustle that, isn't gonna make up for your full-time income right away. You just have that have you have more options available to you. And I think that's at the end of the day what it's all about. And then, looking like longer term, for me, Tesla Daily is not the end of what I want to do. Like I've said that on the podcast many times. I want to, build this into something bigger that can help more and more people. So that's really what I'm focused on now is like how do I get from this where this is today and make this into something that can really change the game for a lot of people. Like I think investing, there's just it's ripe for being disrupted right now, and we're seeing that with all these Tesla YouTubers and I think this is just sort of the tip of the iceberg. Like the game is changing. It's not controlled in this tight-knit Wall Street group anymore. And I think that's exciting and there's a lot of potential there. And I want to be, whatever small part of that I can be. That's what gets me excited about, where this is all heading.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, Wall Street or research is being disrupted. Before, without the internet and technology, it might be like, just put held in certain hands that had closest ties to the management, but with kind of a crowdsourced model, information being public, sources being from everywhere, and it's being democratized in a lot of ways. And I don't think like people understand the full ramifications of how much investing is being disrupted. It's like we're just in the beginning stages.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's huge. I'm curious, with investing, when did you catch that like realization of like, wow, like I want to do this. This is important. Like, when did you catch some vision of what investing could be? Was it something like earlier on in your life, or
I'm trying
was
to
it
remember here, and
later?
I'm kind of laughing because I don't really know if I want to say this because it's so ridiculous, but part of it I think has been innate for me, but part of it I learned just like when I was a kid, I played this game online called Neopets. And it was kind of cool. It was like this online, I was very young, like don't judge me too much, but I played this game called Neopets. It was like this online game and it had like this full economy. Like you could have a store, you could sell to other Neopets users and stuff. And there was like a stock market on it and the currency was like Neo points and you could invest your Neo points in like a bank that had interest and in the stock market, which would, generate returns on you and stuff. So like that's part of where I learned some of this stuff, weirdly enough. But I think I've always just had sort of this like natural interest in it. And over time that involved like I started investing with my very limited capital that I had in high school just from like working, delivering pizzas and stuff, just a couple hundred bucks here and there. I started investing in high school. But even before that, I had interest. Thankfully my first actual investment was Apple. So when you do something like that, it very, very suddenly opens up your eyes to what the potential is. But I think, yeah, I think for me, I've always just had a really good understanding of math, and part of it is just like wanting to not spend my life, at that point I'm doing things like delivering pizzas, like cleaning apartments during apartment turnover, cleaning carpets, and just like that's not what I want to do, for the rest of my life to earn money. So that makes learning about investing and investing, very appealing when you're kind of doing work like that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I love hearing background
Hearing
of
about
like
Neopets.
That's
So
fantastic, because like,
ridiculous.
no, it's not ridiculous in a sense where it's like, no, it's like you caught the potential of like what I guess currency or things can, how you can multiply it or grow it, you know, in environments, and you caught a vision of like, hey, this is in a sense like investing could be like a game in a way too, you know. I mean,
Yeah,
there's
absolutely.
different
Tons of game
moves to
theory involved.
make. Yeah, like there's different factors to absorb. You could lose or you could win.
Yeah,
I mean, there's, I mean, yeah, so
I
I
mean,
mean,
it's fun.
actually,
Like, even for me, like the
yeah.
analysis of it at all, you know, it's fun. Just like, you know, picking the companies you think are gonna succeed. Like, that's why I love business, technology, investing, like all this stuff. It's so fun to just, you know, watch all this play out. And at the same time, it's not like you're just investing and making some money. Like, you're watching these companies disrupt the world. And like, you know, I'm getting a Model 3 in a couple of weeks. Like, that's awesome. I get to have this vehicle that's, you know, a game-changing vehicle that when I was a kid growing up, like, nothing like this existed. So not only are you investing, but you're also learning about like all these technologies and, you know, artificial intelligence and like, you know, batteries. Like, I had no interest in batteries like in high school. That was, my dad's an engineer, but like I just never really had that skill set. But you know, now I'm here reading about like solid state batteries and like, okay, we know cathodes and anodes and all this stuff. And it's just like there's a lot of learning that happens. There's a lot of interesting stuff. And you know, it's exciting to be, you know, it's an exciting world to sort of live in and pay attention to, I think.
Yeah. Have you noticed in your switch from like being an audio podcast to YouTube channel, like what differences have you noticed in terms of your impact, your outreach, your even your processes? Like, how has the difference been? And I guess more specifically, have you noticed in a sense like getting kind of closer to your audience in a way because you're on video format more and like people maybe get to know you a bit more? Like, what's been your experience?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, before I did YouTube, like, you know, I never did a video before. I went on a couple like video podcasts, I think, and you know, I was on Hyperchange with Gallia a couple of times, but you know, I was never really out there sort of, you know, in person. I've always been myself on my podcast, but it is different on video, and I do think it's great to have that sort of connection. I also think YouTube comments really open up that sort of connection. Like, I always had Twitter before and people could talk to me there, but when you have the comment section, it's kind of like directly on this episode, this topic, like let's all talk about this, versus, you know, on Apple Podcasts, for example, like there's no comment section, you know, users can't interact, listeners can't interact with each other there. So that's one of the things I think has been great about YouTube. Like, not only does it, you know, help people find the content, help me make better content that's more valuable, it also gives, you know, people a chance to interact and ask questions. And you know, I'm sure you're in the same boat where I think we're pretty lucky. We have very smart people in our audiences and with a very broad set of knowledge. Like, I'll have engineers commenting on videos if I'm talking about batteries, and you can just super quickly like that learn from these experts in their areas that you could just see your point about research being disrupted. Like, that's exactly what this is. Like, research is happening in YouTube comments now. Like, it's weird, but that is the truth, and it's important. So yeah, it's definitely been super impactful, and definitely was, you know, a good choice.
Yeah, like I noticed, like if I say something a little bit off, or like people will catch it, you know? And so it's
Yes.
fantastic. It's like I get my own kind of like a accountability engine, you know, where, and then
Yeah.
people always like tell me like, oh, you should look into this or look into that, and it's helpful. I love it, you know. It does feel like a group effort, you know, in a lot of
Yeah.
ways.
Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely.
Are you surprised at all that like a lot of your videos get viewed, you know, 50,000, 100,000, or just like that's a lot of people, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Like,
No, yeah, I do know what you're talking about. Yeah. It is pretty crazy. I mean, and especially because I do, like, if I was just talking about Tesla broadly, which, you know, I do, but lately it has been a lot more focused on sort of like the investor angle, which I don't necessarily try to do, but it is just sort of like my natural tendency because that's, you know, that's what I am. But it does surprise me that there's so much interest in sort of like that investing angle. And it's a great thing. Like, it's awesome that so many people are out there, you know, wanting to learn about investing, and you know, I try to be a good source for information for them. So hopefully that means a lot of people are interested in getting accurate information. And I try not to make anything clickbaity. Like, I want interesting looking thumbnails. I want titles that are gonna, hopefully draw people in to learn stuff. But, I'm not out there being like, oh my gosh, like look at this like fail of Tesla, and like they're so screwed now. It's encouraging in a way that there is a demand for sort of what I'm doing. I'm not the most like entertaining presenter by any means. So for people to kind of sit through my monotonous voice day after day is, I guess a good sign.
No, I mean, I look at your stuff as like you have a craft to it. Like you, it's very like intentional. It's very, thought out. And I think people appreciate that. Like you're putting in a lot of time and effort, and they save a lot of time, because
You're right.
you're
And
researching for them in a sense, right? So like
right.
you're their assistant in a sense.
Right. And
And
that's my whole thing is like I want the podcast to be as efficient as possible. Like I pretty heavily edit the audio because I don't want like a single word misplaced in there that is gonna make the video longer and make it harder to understand this point, or people are just gonna not watch it because it's too long. Like I just want to help people get information like as efficiently as possible and as, accurately as possible. And to your point, like I really try to focus that on not even saying a single word incorrectly, because there are going to be those people that point that out, and good for them, because I want that too. Very much a perfectionist, but to get to that level of quality is it takes a lot of work and takes a lot of time, and
yeah, I mean, I for one definitely noticed that, attention to quality, the
Thank you.
efficiency, the focus. But then I've also noticed over time, like your video, the presentation has improved and it's gotten like very, like just very top quality. I'm just like, wow, man, you can like, broadcast quality in a sense. This could be like a daily show on
Yeah.
any TV network. I mean, yeah, it's
Thank you.
super impressed. But it's just a privilege as a person who's seen you, for many years over,
Well, yeah, I think you were the first interview we did on Tesla Daily back in like September of 2017, I want to say.
Yeah, it
Because
was.
I
I
had followed
remember. I
your
was,
stuff on TMC for a long time, so,
yeah, I remember. I was like walking in like our HOA neighborhood, and it was just like on the phone. But like,
Yeah.
yeah, it's different. Yeah,
It was fun.
it
We
is.
should go back and listen to that. I'm sure there were some interesting things there. I remember specifically you talked about like autopilot needing to wait for like a version 3, because it was just like the sort of philosophy that you had, that it's always sort of like the third version of something that really starts to take off. It's like Model 3, hardware version 3, like
Exactly, yeah. Because actually, I remember back then in 2017, people thought, or some people thought, that fully autonomous was coming just in a year or two,
Right.
like completely. And
Yeah.
it's interesting. I mean, I wanted to get your opinion on full self-driving, but first, on your Model 3, why did you get your Model 3 or order one and not a Model Y or something else?
Yeah. I definitely considered a Model Y. It was close. For me, I don't have a family, so I don't really need the extra space. I'm not like a big, outdoorsy camper type of person where I have a lot of equipment that I need to haul around other than like the podcast stuff. So, for me, the Model 3 fits my needs, and then, I'm naturally super frugal, so if I can save, 4 or 5 grand from opting for the Model 3, I'm good with that. And then just having higher efficiency, especially, I haven't looked at the highway efficiency numbers, but I've got to assume that, just based on the larger cross section of the Model Y, that it probably gets a little bit worse efficiency on the highway, even more than like the differences in the EPA ratings, for the Model Y versus the Model 3. So once the heat pump came into the Model Y and sort of everything was similar across the platforms, that was like for me the deciding factor of like, okay, I'm good with the Model 3 now. It's been updated to seemingly have the latest technology. I do live in Wisconsin, so it is a colder climate, so that heat pump was big for me. If that hadn't happened, I probably would have gone with the Model Y. But yeah, it's just a sort of a cost efficiency and a fuel efficiency type of situation for me.
Interesting. Yeah, I have a Model 3 that I, still have, but I'm keeping it because it drives like, to me, I love the driving dynamics of a Model 3 above any other Tesla, like even like a Model S or Model Y. It's just like it's low to the ground. It feels like sporty. And with two kids, like sometimes I'm tempted to go bigger, like Model Y or X, but for me as a driver, I prefer like the Model 3, and I just keep it because of that. But I completely understand where you're coming from. Are you getting the full self-driving package?
Oh, absolutely. That's the main reason I'm getting it. Like, I feel like we're at the point now where, with FSD beta, that I really want to get hands-on and experience these things for myself. Like, I think sometimes people do overemphasize their own personal opinions with or their own personal experiences with products, and I think sometimes that can be a detriment. Obviously, in many cases, it's extremely helpful, but let's take an example of like, oh, this customer had a really bad experience with their delivery with the Tesla, and like they had all these alignment issues, or they had their engine or engine their motor went out in their first 1,000 miles or whatever, and communications were terrible. That person, they might be that 0.1% of people that had a horrible experience, and they might completely write off investing in the company because of that. I think it's more important to, understand the aggregate experience of people. So that's sort of like how I model my investing philosophies. I try not to overemphasize my own personal opinions. I can't remember where we started with this
Full
point,
self-driving,
but
yeah.
full self-driving, yeah. So, but with full self-driving, I think it is, that's one of the areas where I think it is really, really difficult to understand without actually experiencing it for yourself and understanding, how it performs in a variety of use cases. And that's so broad that it's difficult to ascertain that broad perspective from a broad set of people. Like, you just have to read so much, and you'd have to, understand all the characteristics of all the people that you're reading and how accurate they are with their information and stuff. So for me, this is the point where it's like, okay, I just need to have my hands on the wheel and see how this does for myself, because it is, this is a critical part of Tesla's valuation at this point.
Yeah, it makes sense because I think a large part of the full self-driving experience is very nuanced too. It's like how you
It's difficult to like
feel.
explain exactly, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, there's like
Yeah.
this intangible part. With full self-driving, why is it that that's one of the most exciting things that you're seeing for Tesla next year and going forward? Like, what's the big deal? What's the significance of full
Yeah.
self-driving?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think people understand that. Like, I think even if we don't have full robotaxi, autonomous robotaxi, Tesla network type of situation, like we had talked about with the operating leverage, the reason Tesla's valuation is so high is because they're able to sell that software package for $8,000, $10,000. Even if that's only to a certain fraction of their users, that's still having a massive impact on their, profitability, their operating leverage, all this stuff. And that's what takes Tesla from being a $100 billion company like Volkswagen or Toyota to being, I think eventually multi-trillion-dollar company. It's really that software leverage. You just it's really difficult to get to those sort of valuations on hardware margin alone. So, from a business perspective, excited about that. From a personal perspective, like, this is just game-changing technology that's super exciting. Like, I can't wait to, I've experienced autopilot, obviously, but I haven't experienced, the full self-driving beta yet. So it's gonna be pretty cool and exciting to have this car just, driving you around through intersections and stuff, and having the opportunity to even just experience that, I think, is cool in and of itself.
Well, how do you envision the rollout for full self-driving? Like, when, right now it's a very limited beta, it seems, but when do you think wide release will happen? When do you think it progresses, it gets good enough where we see the first deployment of, let's say, robotaxis in a limited area?
Well, so Elon on that recent interview said, he thinks full level 5 2021. I would definitely not be as bullish as that. I think, just judging on the progress so far, I think we're probably still a couple of years away. It's tough because in some circumstances it performs super well, but it doesn't have everything yet. It doesn't have all the edge cases that you would need to have for a full self-driving standalone vehicle with no person in it. Like, a Tesla can complete a trip right now without any interventions. Like, that's awesome, but it needs to be able to complete those, all those trips, every day without any interventions. And that's a big, big difference from being able to just do it on some occasions. So, and then we have things like Smart Summon stuff, and I'm not. Have you seen any videos of Smart Summon with the full self-driving beta? I feel like I haven't seen many of those
Not
yet.
really, yeah.
And I'm not sure why that is, but obviously the performance of Smart Summon hasn't really lived up to, what it was touted to be so far. So those are some of the things I want to see, better performance in the parking lots, and I want to see that a Tesla can actually go and park itself. So those are some of the stuff, things that I'm waiting to see that I haven't seen yet, and some of that may just be I need to look for it. But I still think we're a little bit of a ways from that. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I've been like, as you mentioned, back in 2017, I was like, hey, this is going to take some time because people were expecting the cross-country drive, and in a year or two, everything would be autonomous. So I'm like, this is a tough
Right.
problem, you know? This is like, you've got a lot of edge cases and you're dealing with safety, life and death of a person. So it's going to take longer than what some people think. But then more recently, I've kind of shifted, actually, personally, where I think Tesla has hit some type of tipping point with their latest rewrite, also with their Dojo computer coming online probably next year. I think there's something where they have nailed the infrastructure and they've nailed all the major pieces, where it's just a matter now of improving with data and training. And so I think people are going to be super impressed by the rate of progress, the results. And I think by the end of this year, it's going to be like people are going to start to catch it, like, wow, this is huge. But then by the end of next year, I think this thing is going to be pretty good. I don't know like exactly the rollout in terms of which areas are going to have robotaxis or not, because each municipality will have to determine like their own regulations. But like I think yeah, I think it's like it has momentum, you know. This is the
Yeah.
time where I'm getting very bullish on full
Yeah.
self-driving. Yeah.
And that's to what we were talking about earlier. Like that's why I want to have my hands on it so I can kind of judge that for myself. 'Cause right now it's difficult to like fully process and understand that from just like watching a couple of YouTube videos, which, you know, who knows like how much of their experience they're sharing and stuff like that. So I definitely want to experience it myself. And then, but to your point, like I think we've been maybe lulled into this false sense of like slow progress because of what has been going on behind the scenes with them really doing this rewrite of fundamentally how the system is working. And you know, they've been talking about that, of course, but we haven't really seen much progress from it up until this full self-driving beta, because all this stuff has been happening behind the scenes. So it's kind of like, oh, well, you know, they reached this local maximum and progress kind of tapered off, but now we're in this new sort of, you know, space where they have this rewrite, and now we're seeing progress like rapidly every week. And if that continues, then that bodes super well for, you know, when we're 52 weeks out from here, where they've just kept iterating. And the other, you know, tailwind that Tesla is riding here is just the amount of data that's coming in. It just continues to be amplified and amplified and amplified as their, you know, their fleet grows so quickly. You know, 500,000 vehicles this year, maybe 850,000 next year, something like that. Like that's gonna, it almost doubles the fleet in terms of what the in terms of like the Hardware 3 fleet. So that's another thing that, you know, I think is gonna be super beneficial. And then as you mentioned with Dojo, like that's kind of why I say maybe a couple years from now, because I think once they get Dojo going, I feel like they probably need that before it's really ready for like an autonomous taxi type situation. So that's why I think maybe, you know, 2 to 3 years from now, we could be in a situation where that's happening. But I would love to be wrong on that. Like, I think people do underestimate the rate of progress sometimes in situations like this. So we'll
Yeah,
see.
definitely. So it seems like we have operating leverage and profits, you know, that is super exciting. And then you've got this whole full self-driving. So just those two things are just immensely, like, they have immense potential, you know, for Tesla. But then Tesla isn't stopping there. They've got this whole Roadrunner line, 4680 cells, cell to chassis stuff going on. And then they've got all these factories, right? You have Austin, you have Berlin, Shanghai expanding. In your opinion, I guess, with these new production of 4680 cells, like, how do you envision, is it going to be a challenge for Tesla to get up to speed and actually be able to make Model Ys with these 4680 cells? Do you envision more of a slow ramp, or do you think that Tesla has something up their sleeves and they're actually going to, like, ramp in decent amounts in
Yeah.
Berlin and Austin?
I feel like a little bit of both, because I do think there are going to be issues ramping. I think that's the biggest risk factor in my mind for, you know, 2021. But I also think Tesla's probably a little bit further down the road than they have let on. They've already got the pilot line running. They already have successfully created their own battery cells that are in their products that they've been testing. If you listen carefully to what they said at Battery Day, they were cautious, but a lot of the caution was around the yield rate. So they're able to do this. It's just a matter of doing it well enough that the yield rate is high enough for it to be cost efficient and to be fast enough, obviously. So, it's a matter of they've got these things down. They just need to iterate on them and improve them. And I think that's something that Tesla is insanely good at, and it happens, pretty darn quickly. Like, if we think about the Model 3, how sort of painful that felt at the time, just because they kept missing targets. If you actually look at it in hindsight, they went from doing nothing to doing, thousands of vehicles a week in a year, and this is the first time they've, done any sort of high volume manufacturing pretty much at all. And they've got experience with that now. They've got experience. I think they've been probably working on this pilot line stuff for quite a while now, and for them to publicly put those targets out when I think, setting aside sort of autonomy, I think Tesla has been relatively conservative in terms of what they've been able to, what they've communicated publicly about, vehicle deliveries and stuff like that. There's definitely been more caution there. So for them to publicly talk about this, and we got to remember too, Battery Day was like 6 months delayed. So they really intended to actually do this back in March. And I think maybe that sort of throws people off a little bit in terms of where Tesla's actual progress is at. So I think it's kind of, I'm talking out of both ends of my mouth a little bit there. There is definitely risk to that production ramp up, and we shouldn't count that as like a foregone conclusion. But at the same time, I do feel like Tesla's probably pretty far along in the process. And some of the stuff that they mentioned as, potentially having issues, like they don't necessarily need all that stuff to actually get a product out the door and into a car. Like it'll be a continuous sort of improvement type of thing. So yeah, that's sort of my thoughts.
Do you think they'll actually be able to produce more than, let's say, 10 or 20,000 Cybertrucks next year by the end of the year?
Ooh, Cybertrucks. I don't know. I'm more bullish on the Model Y from Berlin, just because that's a vehicle they've done before. Cybertruck, I think, is probably going to be pretty slow in terms of how it ramps up, just because it is, that's an entirely new type of vehicle, with the exoskeleton manufacturing process. And there needs to be new things developed by Tesla to be able to do that. So I'm not as bullish on that ramp up as probably I am on just the 4680s in general. 2022, I think for sure they'll do a significant number of Cybertrucks, but when we think about Cybertruck's a different product category, but if we look at like the Semi and the Roadster, these carry new technologies with them, and those have definitely been a little bit slower than what we have seen. Tesla says that was because of the batteries and stuff, which, totally makes sense, but I do think it's gonna, probably take a little bit longer for the Cybertruck.
What's your guesstimate in terms of what year do you think Tesla would make a Tesla RV?
Is that a personal question there, Dave? I
I need to know. I need to know. I've got some
hope they
planning to
do.
do. I've got
Yeah,
some planning to
no.
do, so
I hope they do. I mean, so we got to think, the next big focus is going to be sort of that $25,000 car.
sure.
Sounds like that'll be like an international project, though. Probably designed in, maybe Shanghai and Berlin or something like that. But if we think about like products coming out of Fremont or coming out of Texas, I wouldn't be too surprised if that was on the roadmap, at some point. It's tough because I don't know. Do you know the volume of like RVs every year? It's got to be not all that high, right?
I forget the exact volume, but it's actually decent. It's
Okay.
like, yeah,
Like
hundreds of
worth
thousands.
doing. Okay. I mean, if they did, like that's the dream, right? Is having this autonomous RV that you like, it's a mobile hotel room that you just like turn on and it just goes wherever you want. Like that's awesome. And hopefully Tesla does that. Which, if they do, that's going to be disruptive to like the hotel industry too, which is, a lot of people aren't talking about that or thinking about that yet, but it's going to be, especially with this Airbnb IPO, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
While we're on kind of the future stuff, like, are there any crazy future products or things that you think Tesla might get into that just is unexpected or just, let's say 10 years down the road or, even 15 years down the road?
The obvious ones are obviously like home HVAC system, electric jet. I would love to see Tesla do something in the water space, ships or boats or personal watercraft. I don't know that the market, it might not justify that. Because this is what's tough about Tesla is they're going to get so big so fast that all of these sort of categories that would be super exciting for consumers are potentially going to be not that beneficial to Tesla's business at the scale that Tesla's going to be, because they're going to be producing, in a decade, I think probably 20 million cars a year, doing trillion, over $1 trillion in revenue. So it's like, okay, well, what markets are going to enter then that are worth your time? And they become sort of fewer and fewer. So it's tough. I don't know. I mean, I guess what I would say is when we think about it, like when we frame it that way, it's probably got to be something that's, technology related. And I would say that comes back to what Tesla's doing with Dojo. I think there's probably opportunity to extend that maybe in sort of a way that is similar to what Amazon's done with AWS. Tesla might be able to leverage their skills in that area to sell those resources off to other companies that are also looking to do things with artificial intelligence. So if I think about like a product line that, has potential for Tesla, where they're gonna that's gonna matter enough to the scale that Tesla's gonna be in 5 to 10 years, like I gotta focus in on something like AI related. It just kind of has to be of that sort of, scales. That's
Interesting.
kind of what I'm thinking.
I was this past yesterday I was watching this IPO roadshow video of DoorDash, and I think they're at like a $55 billion valuation right now with local delivery. And it was fascinating because they're trying to create a local infrastructure, logistics infrastructure. So they say, oh, food is just the first step, right? We're creating this thing where local businesses can give goods and services to anyone, anytime. And their goal is to help these small businesses kind of survive and succeed in a new economy. Now, I was thinking about, it overlaps with Tesla in some ways because of delivery, transportation, because that's got to be one of the biggest kind of hurdles or costs. And then you have Uber being valued, almost $100 billion. And I wonder, like, what's your kind of take on the future of Tesla in delivery or in logistics? Like, do you think these companies like Uber or DoorDash or even Instacart, like they provide a great service, like we order stuff and we get the food, but like, how do these companies compete in a world with robotaxi? It
Right.
just like cuts the cost of transport so drastically. Like, I mean, yeah, what's your take on that?
Yeah, no, it's a great thing to think about. I think it's something. I think when people think about autonomy, there are a couple of things that they think about, like semis autonomously delivering packages, and then an Uber type of situation where you have this, car you can summon and it drops you off. But I think that's sort of like the first order of thinking. There's going to be a lot more that develops just out of the sheer lower cost of what an autonomous vehicle can do. And I haven't spent a ton of time thinking about what opportunities there are, but there are definitely things that are not happening today that are just going to be completely new that are being done with these autonomous vehicles that, just doesn't exist today. Whether that's like car sharing in the suburbs or, whatever else, like all these, everything that DoorDash is talking about, like, yeah, I think it's irrevocably intertwined with what Tesla is doing with autonomy. And whether Tesla decides to sort of pursue those markets on their own, under their own, corporate structure, or if they want to decide to partner with some of these companies, because it's not necessarily going to be worth Tesla to just like try and do everything. And I think if we think about robotaxis, like that's one of the cool things about Tesla's business model right now is like allowing customers to actually buy those, and then customers are taking care of sort of the infrastructure, which is really cool for Tesla because that generates leverage. So yeah, maybe they'll give a better rate to these people that are operating these robotaxis than they could get on their own, but they're also saving all of that capital cost from having to like find garages for these robotaxis and things like that. So diverting a little bit from your question there, but I think logistics business is going to be huge. You know, how Tesla plays in that, TBD, but they're definitely going to be involved. You can't not be. And I think that extends to all of these like personal logistics type of situations too. And yeah, probably all the stuff that DoorDash is talking about would be somehow under Tesla's, you know, realm of what they can play in.
I remember this is probably 2014 or something. I was like at a Tesla event. I think it was their Powerwall event, their first Powerwall or something around then. And I was talking with JB Straubel. Back in the day, I used to make sure to go to every Tesla event because the management were just hanging around,
Yeah,
just
they were small enough
like
then.
talking.
I
Yeah, they
missed
were
that
just
period of time.
accessible. I would do anything and everything I could to go to these events. But I was talking to JB Straubel, and then we're talking about kind of, transportation, and he made something an interesting point. He's like, yeah, it's like, it's transporting, from point A to point B, and it could be people or it could be goods. And so I was like, huh, it's like even in 2014, Tesla is thinking about transporting goods and people, point A to point B, looking at it really from like a first principles point of view. And I think that's one of the reasons why they're so all in autonomous driving, because like this is clearly the future. It's like, the most efficient, best way. But with delivering goods, one of the challenges I see is you send a robotaxi from the grocery store, from the restaurant to the person's house or apartment building. How does that package, that food, that whatever, get from the car to the person or in front of the person's house? Like you need a person then, right? Like so the robotaxi fulfills like 80 or 90% of the routes, but the remaining 10 or 20%, it's like that's a huge challenge, It's like, do you think Tesla could make a robot that would take the food, the bags or whatever, the package from the car to the person, but then you would deal with like elevators, you deal with like city streets, you deal with, there's so many situations. So it seems like a huge challenge. Drones would be interesting, but then there are regulations. Would you really want drones with big packages flying above people's heads? I don't know. What are your thoughts? What are the
No,
choices?
it's a great question. I'm thinking about it from like my perspective. So I live in an apartment, and for us it would be super easy because that would probably just be a role that would be taken on by like the apartment management. They would just collect those packages and, you know, put them in the mailboxes or whatever they need to do with them when the cars arrive. So I think that would be pretty simple from my perspective, but for, you know, a suburban house, like then what do? You got to have some way for it to get out of the vehicle. And, you know, you can just have it sit there until the person comes, but then, you know, obviously they need to sort of schedule it so that the person is there, and that's not ideal either. They could have something where it's just sort of like pushing the package out of the car, you know. At this point in time, maybe it's not even doesn't even look like a car anymore. Maybe it's something else, but there could be something that just sort of, you know, shifts it from being carried by the car to just being on the side of the road or something like that. But that's not ideal because then you know, your package is just kind of sitting there. So you're left with, you know, kind of what you said of like, okay, well, how do you get it from the driveway essentially to actually into the house? And yeah, I don't know. I don't know that there's going to be a good solution for that anytime soon. So I'd imagine it comes down to sort of like scheduling and things like that, or having, I don't know, maybe there's someone in the car that we get back to having a person, you know?
Yeah,
It's
exactly.
kind of like the Model 3 ramp up of like, oh, people are actually pretty good at doing stuff. Yeah. So I don't know.
I think the challenge is interesting because it really is going to require some crazy, like creativity, engineering, something to finish that last, 10 or 20%. And of any company out there, like seems like Tesla would be the company to do something, I find it
Well, I definitely
fascinating.
know there are definitely companies out there that are working on that. Like I've seen, I don't follow it super closely, but I've definitely seen articles or videos talking about these sort of like package delivery robots that basically do what you're talking about here. So there are definitely people working on that problem. And I suppose if we can have full self-driving cars on the road, like why not have something that is not on the road, that's not going at high speed, that's also autonomous and first principles thinking, like obviously we should be able to do that. So I think it's just a matter of like cost and how those robots all get around and if it makes sense.
I'm curious with full self-driving going forward. Some people have speculated that, oh, Tesla is going to stop selling cars to consumers because they will use all of their production for robotaxis. And so some people think that in the future, it'll just be Tesla's robotaxis and everyone will do rideshare. Some other people might say, oh, maybe there'll be a couple years where Tesla is just producing a ton of robotaxis for their own networks, and maybe they sell only like a limited amount to consumers because they're using a lot for the robotaxis. What's your take? Do you think Tesla will continue to prioritize selling cars to consumers, or do you think that's in flux?
I do because that offloads a lot of problems to the consumer. To some extent, Tesla's kind of already doing that of like they're offloading the problem of collecting data to the consumer, and it's sort of a win-win. The consumer gets the car and they get to use this great technology. But it's for Tesla, it's better than having to pay a bunch of people to go drive their cars around. So to some extent, they're doing that. But I think back to the infrastructure point, these customers are going to take care of the car. They're going to take care of where to park it, charging it, things like that. If Tesla wants to have their own robotaxi fleet, they need to have a plan for doing all that. They need to have a plan for maintenance. They have to have somewhere to store it. It can't just drive around roads all the time when it's not being like from, let's say, midnight to like 5 a.m. when there's pretty low traffic. What are you going to do with these cars if they're not in someone's garage? You're going to have your own garage, or you're going to have, again, just have them driving around, which is a poor use of our road infrastructure and a poor use of the vehicle's capacity. So I think they're going to offload a lot of that to customers for the foreseeable future. Maybe at some point it makes sense for Tesla in some localities to have some of that infrastructure in-house, but I would imagine the majority of Tesla's plan is to let customers take care of that. And Elon has mentioned a couple of times about taxi drivers becoming these sort of fleet managers. And I think that gives a hint of, what he's got in his head of how this is all going to work out.
All right, Rob, I'm gonna go ahead and wrap up my
Yeah, that's a
questions
great spot
here.
for it.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. I love talking, chatting with you. I feel like we're in the middle of a lot of historic changes in our world and society. And I think Tesla and also SpaceX in some ways too. Like,
Yeah.
there's a lot of companies, but it feels like it's fascinating to see a lot of these changes happening before our eyes. And not just the changes, but to see it also in terms of the market dynamics and investors' like views and sentiments changing. And it's just a fascinating journey, I think. I think, yeah, there could be many years to come, to see what
Yeah.
this story, how this story rolls
Oh,
out. So,
absolutely.
yeah, definitely
All
want
right,
to
well,
thank you. So I'll
awesome.
hand it back to you.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. I really appreciate you coming on. So like I said at the beginning, we're gonna do another one of these in a couple weeks where I'll be on Dave's channel kind of asking him a lot of the, sort of type of questions that that he asked me today, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more about SpaceX and some of the other companies that we're following or that you're following. So yeah, so Dave Lee on Investing is the YouTube channel. Make sure to check that out. I think you're at Hey Dave 7 on Twitter. I think I got that right.
Yes.
So definitely follow Dave on Twitter. But yeah, I really appreciate you coming on, taking the time to ask me some of these questions today. And hopefully you guys all enjoyed the discussion out there. And yeah, that'll wrap it up for me for the week. And I'll see you guys on, what is it, Monday, December 14th for S&P 500 Inclusion Week. Big week. All right, thanks, Dave. Thanks, everybody.
Awesome.